Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Oh, there we go. Got to fix my camera. Today, I am with John Haar. He is a member of Swan. Also, I also work at Swan. So we're gonna talk to him about his experience in Wall Street, how it was coming into Bitcoin. But before I bring him on the stage, I want to give a shout out to the awesome Bitcoin company that powers the show. Shout out to swanbitcoin.com, best place to stack sats, buy Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners, dollar cost average. Also, they incentivize self-custody. You could buy Bitcoin from $10 all the way to $10 million. What are you waiting for? Visit swanbitcoin.com today. John, how you doing? Welcome to the show. Happy to have you. I'm gonna rip off the band-aid right from the get-go. You spent 13 years at Goldman Sachs, and you transitioned into working at a Bitcoin company. That's absolutely crazy. And before I pass it on to you, I actually, one of my best friends from high school, he took down that pass. I actually works at Goldman here in Miami. And I bring up Bitcoin to him, and like out of the five or six friends that I grew up with, all of them, you know, have some exposure to Bitcoin at this point. But this one guy works at Goldman. It's like garlic and a vampire. Like he's like, no, like I can't touch that. You know, it's not okay. So, what woke you up, and what made you a believer?
Yeah, great place to start. And thanks for having me, Nico. Really good to be here. It reminds me, what you just said reminds me of one of those memes floating out there on Twitter that says some of the last people to get Bitcoin will be the Wall Street suits. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's probably a good thing. But I can totally relate to what you said there. I tried to talk to my coworkers at Goldman for years, not even about Bitcoin, just about sound money, about gold, about the monetary system as it is today. And most of the time, believe it or not, they actually don't want to talk about that. Or if they do, it's very brief. They're not really interested in it. And we can certainly get into more about how Wall Street perceives Bitcoin. But I think it actually helps to talk a little bit about the people who make up Wall Street and how they think, how they act, how they were educated. And I could totally see an outsider thinking, oh, those people on Wall Street, you know, they must be so fond of fiat currency. They must be sitting in rooms talking about how great the fiat monetary system is. But I can tell you that's actually not the case for the vast, vast majority of people who work on Wall Street. For the vast majority of them, they're not even thinking about the design of the current monetary system. So that's kind of usually how I start, by saying it's not as if there's these huge proponents of the existing system. I think most of them are not even thinking about it.
I mean, you could make the argument that they're benefactors of the existing system. And I think that's perhaps why they're blind to it, right? Like they benefit from the fiat system itself. I will never forget when he said this to me. I was like, look, like, you know, the monetary policy is set in stone, you know, it's 21 million roughly every 4 years, right? There's a supply shock caused by the halving, you know, it really protects the little guy, right, from currency debasement, from censorship. And he looked at me straight in the eye. He said, Nico, the people need monetary policy. And then at that point I was like, holy cow, he is such a staunch believer in the system, just as us Bitcoiners are staunch believers in the system. But why wouldn't he be? You think about it, right? You know, you get to be after associate, get to be vice president, you're making $250,000 plus the bonus a year, right? You have absolutely no incentive to really ask questions, do you? Because you're being treated, you're you know, in the hierarchy of the system, you're like a prince in the fiat system, and it's being good to you. You're not incentivized to try to understand something that could potentially undermine your business.
Totally, totally. And I think this actually gets to a good example of an analogy of what I think describes many people on Wall Street is that they're more like mercenaries. And for people who are, you know, that's not a word that people use every day. So anyone who's unfamiliar with it, it's a hired soldier. And it's someone who gets paid to fight in a conflict, but they aren't actually from either side of the conflict. So this would be like Hessian soldiers in the Revolutionary War. They're from Germany fighting on the side of Britain against the Americans, but you know, they didn't really have a dog in the fight other than the fact that Britain is paying them. And that's actually what I would describe most people on Wall Street as. They basically just say, hey, I'm a good soldier, and if you pay me a good amount, I'll be on your side. And that describes most people on Wall Street. And to be very clear, I'm not saying everyone on Wall Street is a bad person. I have tons of contacts from my 13 years working on Wall Street. A lot of really, really good people work there. But it's just that they aren't examining the fundamentals of the system. So, you know, there could be a person who has four kids. Their life is very, very busy. They're just trying to show up to work, earn a salary, support their family. Nothing wrong with that. You know, I totally respect that. But we can't forget the fact that somebody has to be thinking about whether we have a logical, ethical, sustainable monetary system. And if we don't have that, you know, on the other hand, do we have a system that produces wealth confiscation, unnatural wealth concentration, and then I would argue economic distortions and destruction. And to state the obvious, Bitcoiners have a deep interest in developing a system that's logical, fair, ethical, sustainable. And the people on Wall Street just generally opt out of that conversation. They kind of just say, hey, I'm here to earn a living and get paid doing this very specialized thing on Wall Street, and I'm just going to keep doing that and living my life. That describes the vast majority of people on Wall Street.
So let's talk. I'm really curious, like what, so, you know, I personally, I'll tell you about my story just a bit, just to give this context, right? I really fell into Bitcoin 2016. It was a terrible moment in my life, you know, down in the gutter, so to speak. And I was desperate, and luckily for me, I just happened to, you know, put everything I have in Bitcoin, and then it kind of worked out, right? But someone in your position, right, that, you know, Goldman pays very well, benefits, all the perks. What made you leave? Like, what made you want to walk away from that, right? And if you go down and use the Bitcoin jargon and all that stuff, right, you were a main benefactor of the fiat system. What incentive did you have to leave? And I really do find that fascinating, because, you know, speaking to my high school friend, he is so entrenched, you know, and why wouldn't he be, you know, getting paid tons of money. So what made you leave? What was it, an integrity thing? Were you looking at it? You're like, no, like, this is broken. This is messed up. Did it interest you?
Yeah, man. I will give the semi short version of my Bitcoin story to answer that. And my Bitcoin story arguably starts in 2008. And people are probably saying, what the hell is this guy talking about? Bitcoin wasn't even released at that point. But for me, the Bitcoin story actually starts with the financial crisis. And I was a senior in college as the financial crisis was happening. So that was the fall of 2008, spring of 2009. That was my senior year of college. And I was a finance major. So I was taking finance and economics classes as the financial crisis is unfolding before our eyes. And I'm looking around saying, okay, my teachers can't really explain what's going on. Ben Bernanke can't explain what's going on. The Treasury Secretary can't explain what's going on. No one on CNBC or Bloomberg can explain it either. So I'm just looking around saying, you know, these are the experts that we're supposed to have trust in to figure these things out before they happen. So I'm seeing the entire system just unravel. You know, we could have a whole show about things Bernanke said, but you know, he was literally saying things on TV and then being proven wrong like 7 days later. You know, the housing crisis is contained to subprime. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are not at risk of financial losses. We won't experience a decline in housing prices on a nationwide level. I'm watching him say those things. And then, you know, a week or two later, he's just proven completely wrong. So for me, I had to look somewhere else. And that somewhere else for me ended up being Austrian economics and the Mises Institute at Mises.org. So that for me was a path of learning about economics that I was not getting at the university level. I certainly didn't get it at the high school level. And that led me to all the things that the Austrians believe in, whether you want to broadly call it free markets, private property, and obviously sound money. So I became a proponent of sound money, which at the time meant the gold standard. There was no other option for sound money. I didn't even hear of Bitcoin personally until 2013. But starting around 2009, I'm doing my own research in economics, reading tons of things on the Mises Institute, and I become this proponent of sound money, the gold standard. And what was really interesting about that is I brought this up to lots of people at Goldman Sachs and wanted to get their reaction to it. Just like something along the lines of, you know, do you guys know that gold used to be money for hundreds, if not thousands of years? And, you know, now it's not money anymore. They kind of removed that anchor from the paper, but just like falling on deaf ears, no one wants to have that conversation. So that was pretty interesting to me. I was just like, wow, people are not interested in this. Fast forward to 2013, when I mentioned I first heard of Bitcoin. And the part that I guess it might sound like I'm patting myself on the back a little bit is I immediately thought it was incredible because I was like, wow, they're trying to do sound money in digital form. But unfortunately, the next thought I had was that will never, ever catch on. And I thought that because there I was from 2009 to 2013 having conversations with coworkers at Goldman and people who work at other successful companies. And if I brought up the gold standard or the history of money, I mean, and if I suggested that the gold standard was actually better for certain reasons, they looked at me like I had 10 heads. So my thought was, if these people don't want to hear about the gold standard, they don't want to hear about the history of money, the nature of money, then they're just never going to go for this thing called Bitcoin that's like the magic internet money. You know, in my opinion, it was like, doesn't even matter if Bitcoin works the way they say it does. It's just not going to catch on. So that was unfortunately my first view of Bitcoin in 2013. And then I did not come around to it again until 2017. And it was that mainstream bull market that the price ran up. People are talking about it on CNBC, on Bloomberg. We're even talking about it on our floor at Goldman Sachs at that point. And that's when I said, okay, hey, you know what? Maybe this thing is real and maybe it has legs and people are talking about it and maybe it's going to become a real thing and stick around. So that was kind of the point where I said, okay, this thing seems real. But at that point, there wasn't a ton of content to consume. It wasn't like it is today where you can listen to so many different podcasts just by walking out your front door with your phone or so many different people on Bitcoin Twitter. There just wasn't that much information. So it was kind of slow learning process about Bitcoin for me. And then the other thing was there wasn't really a place that it made sense to work for someone like myself back in 2017. So you fast forward a little bit and, you know, 2020, 2021, companies like Swan are being built that are vocally Bitcoin only. In my opinion, they clearly get the thesis of what Bitcoin is meant to be, a superior form of non-state, immutable, digital, scarce, peer-to-peer, censorship-resistant money to be contrasted with, you know, pick your own crypto casino. I never had an interest in working at one of those. So basically, to sum everything I just said up, I had this passion for sound money that started in 2008. once I started learning about sound money and the gold standard. And then finally, 2021, 2022, I was seeing companies that were built with a thesis to promote Bitcoin and make it easier for people to learn about it, accumulate it, custody it, and then self-custody it. And I saw a company like Swan, and I just said, wow, I'm totally aligned with what this company is looking to build, and met a bunch of the people at Swan. And it just reinforced my belief that I think the company's looking to build something very strong with staying power. And that's kind of the summary of how I ended up getting to the point saying, you know what, I think it makes sense to take the leap from Goldman into a Bitcoin only company like Swan.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's fascinating because I felt the same way. Right. But I came from it, not from, you know, traditional finance background. I came from it from a content creation background. Right. And really what I see happening, right, John, is there is, again, this is all content, you know, type of outlook. The way that I'm approaching it is we're in a war, but it's not a kinetic war. It's a war over hearts and minds, and really winning over people and really kind of opening up their eyes to, hey, there's a better alternative. It's a non-state alternative, and it doesn't steal from you. But the state benefits tremendously from having this privilege of being able to basically create money for free. And, you know, it really falls to content creators to really, you know, be on the front lines of that, you know, what I call the narrative trench warfare. And same thing. One of the things that that attracted me to Swan as well was they were on the mission. They completely understood that. So it's just so fascinating to me how people from different walks of life, where normally you would have never like would have conceived it, Bitcoin kind of provides this like single pillar of truth, and everyone's like trying to basically go towards it and really push what, you know, and the beauty of Bitcoin is the incentives are aligned, right? That's one of the most beautiful things about Bitcoin is that you acting out of your own self-interest, not only are you making the network stronger, but you're also helping people in the process. And it kind of creates this dynamic where everybody could win. And that's something extremely unique to Bitcoin that I really haven't seen anywhere else. Now, you mentioned 2017. What made you so most Bitcoiners that I've spoken to, they all go through a shitcoin phase. In my case individually, I was able to, I did dabble, of course, but I always knew that Bitcoin was different because I got into Bitcoin through the mining front. So I always knew the infrastructure behind it. And to me, it was just like, this thing's very unique, right? So how did you know Bitcoin, not shitcoins? Or did you kind of have to pay your price of tuition? Did you learn the hard way? What made you sure?
I think I might be one of the very few people who didn't have a shitcoin phase, but I really credit that to the Mises Institute and Austrian economics, because I think a lot of people get into Bitcoin for different reasons. I think people who might get into it for the tech side of things, that is kind of an easier path towards getting into, you know, XYZ shitcoin, because some other coin comes out and says, hey, look, we're better tech. We've got these bells and whistles on it. And then someone gets excited about what the price chart looks like. And then they get into that, you know, for those reasons. Even if they don't think it has long-term staying power, maybe they just think, you know, they can get in and out and benefit from it. But because I was in this for the same reason I was into gold and sound money in general, to me, it didn't make sense for there to be multiple of them. That was like an initial thing in my own thesis. But I will say, I guess the one thing to add to all that is it wasn't as if 2017 came and I was like, okay, Bitcoin's the only one. This is obvious now. It wasn't quite that simple. I can still remember seeing CNBC. It was Roger Ver on CNBC talking about Bitcoin Cash. And that part confused the heck out of me. I was not following Bitcoin enough to know what was going on in real time in the block size wars. Obviously, everyone can read the incredible book by Jonathan Bier about the block size wars. I kind of learned all that after the fact. What I was seeing at the time was there's this guy who apparently has a big voice within Bitcoin is now going on TV saying that the real Bitcoin is Bitcoin Cash. And to me, I was incredibly confused by it because I'm just sitting there thinking, you know, if this is sound money, there's not really supposed to be, you know, 100 of them or even 2 of them, quite frankly. You know, gold was money. I guess you could argue silver became a form of money, but there's really not supposed to be a lot of forms of money. That's one of the things about money. As people have said, it's the world's largest social network. But Roger Ver shows up on TV and he says, Bitcoin Cash is the real thing. And I remember feeling genuinely confused. I was like, I don't know what to make of this. Which one's the real Bitcoin? And it wasn't until I didn't step back and say, okay, I'm done with Bitcoin because this is too confusing now. But I do remember just saying, okay, the price just crashed from, you know, whatever it did, almost 20K down to like 3K maybe, or, you know, whatever it did. And then I just said to myself, okay, I'm going to watch this because if Bitcoin can be sound money, then I'm incredibly interested. And if it can't for some reason, then I will become less interested. But 2017 was the time where I said, this has gotten big enough that it's worth me following. And then that's what I did for the next several years. And thankfully, the content creation just got so much better. It's just amazing if you think about how much content you can consume about Bitcoin today versus what you could have done in 2018. I mean, it's just light years ahead. And I think that's one of the reasons why Bitcoin is spreading so quickly. But yeah, that's kind of my story and how things played out around the 2017 timeframe.
It's interesting because 2017 was very scary during the block size wars because there was that one point, and again, I came to it and I was looking at it, not so much getting distracted by the bells and whistles with a lot of the shit coins did this. I was looking at the hash rate, right? The hash rate, you know, represents the, you know, computational power, theoretically mining Bitcoin at the time. And there was a point where the Bitcoin Cash hash rate overtook Bitcoin's twice. We now know, looking back, they did that artificially. They didn't do that just because of market forces. They did that because they were lighting money on fire to try to psyop people into thinking Bitcoin Cash is a real deal, right? You know, higher hash rate, you could have made the argument that those, for that very brief second, theoretically, Bitcoin Cash was more computationally secure than Bitcoin. And I was looking at it from that perspective and I was like, holy cow, this is insane. But of course, you know, you can only light money on fire for so long before you run out of money. And that's the beauty of Bitcoin. You can't just print more of it. So Roger Ver and Jihan, dude, they have significantly less Bitcoin today, thank God, than they would have had if they, you know, to use Odell's famous line, just stayed humble, stack sats. And it's absolutely beautiful. But yeah, it was a very scary moment. And what you were saying about content, man, we're very fortunate enough simply to kind of be in the very, very inception of when you started seeing daily Bitcoin shows. Like, we were one of the first. Before, it was non-existent. You had podcasts. Podcasts were very popular, but they didn't exist. And now, all of a sudden, not only do you have Bitcoin shows, but you have these high quality production, like type of, you know, full bells and whistles. And I think that's what's necessary, because without that, what you're really competing against this well-entrenched machine, right? That's getting this type of information out there. If our side doesn't fight back. Of course, I'm not talking about peacefully. I'm not talking about violently or kinetically, but at least provide a counter narrative to a lot of the legacy media hit pieces. Like, if you've seen the hit pieces by Reuters against Nayib Bukele, like, it's been absolutely disgusting. But that tells me that they're terrified of this thing. They're very, very scared. Nayib Bukele wrote this amazing article for Bitcoin Magazine called "Don't Drink the Elite's Kool-Aid," right? Makes the case that they, you know, they own the militaries, they own the companies, but they also control the truth. And that's one of the most important things that they have. And the internet has given individuals, Bitcoiners, this ability to completely circumvent those gatekeepers of information. Like, you just go all around them and you go directly to other individuals and they kind of freak out. They don't know what to do, but it's crazy. And the case that I've been making, John, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, is not only are we like living through the disintermediation of money, but before that, right before that, I think what really started was also the disintermediation of information, right? And it's just causing this complete chaos. You don't know what to think. The legacy sources that Americans have trusted for decades and decades have started to lie to them. They've been the ones that are, you know, telling, I don't want to say lies, a very strong word, but you could say that their interests have been co-opted by very powerful institutions. I'll put it gently. And it's just, what a crazy time to be alive. And I think most people are asleep to it still, and it's a shame. So I don't know. What do you think?
You remind me of the thesis in the incredible book, The Sovereign Individual, which most Bitcoiners know very well. And they liken what is going on in the current era to what happened around the year 1500 in the Protestant Reformation with the era of the printing press. And basically, you know, the way it goes is there is a technological innovation that allows for, in this case, both information to be spread drastically differently than it was previously. And, you know, the TLDR is that the stranglehold that the Catholic Church had on over Europe dramatically fell apart. And you could trace a lot of it back to the printing press and the spreading of that information. And this book, Sovereign Individual, when they forecast things going forward, one of the things that they highlighted was the existence of, I won't get this exactly right, but they said something like an anonymous digital cyber cash. And this book was written in, I think, 1997, or give or take a year. And they also forecasted something that they called narrow casting,
yes,
which essentially is social media. So I think your point is a good one, that obviously, you know, we're all here because of Bitcoin and how important we think it is, but it arguably goes beyond that. It's disintermediating the people who control the monetary system, whether that's inflating the money or whether that is providing access to it, right? Inflation and censorship are both the huge things that come with a centralized, centrally controlled monetary system. Whether it's the monetary system or whether it is the central control of information and narratives, if that comes out through just a handful of media outlets, that's arguably pretty centrally controlled. And nowadays, I think we have a lot more voices out there. That doesn't mean every single voice is accurate about what they say, but it means that centralized parties cannot control the narrative as easily. So yeah, I think that point is a good one, that it's about the monetary system, but it's just about decentralization in general. I kind of hate the fact that, you know, so many shitcoins out there have abused the word decentralized, but I'm using the word in the true sense of it. Truly decentralized social media, truly decentralized money. I think it's ultimately a good thing. And I think it's one of the biggest trends that we're going to see play out over the next 5, 10, 20 years.
So Another conversation that I had with Dr. Jeff Ross, he's one of the, what I call the macro heavyweights on Twitter, right? Love the guy. You have Greg Foss, you have James Lavish, you have Lepard, right? And, you know, Dr. Jeff Ross is one of the big guys. Forgive me if I'm missing one. But the case that he was making, he says, Nico, if we're successful in a way, you know, and he's talking about the position of his fund, right? It kind of takes away my job. And Parker Lewis wrote this amazing piece called The Great Definance. That's a really difficult word, but you know what I'm talking about. The definancialization. Ha, I got it. Not bad. English is my second language. Okay. So he wrote that piece and he's basically making the case that because money steals from you, right? It's not that big of a deal. If you have $100, right, and the inflation rate is 2%, you know, ideally in an ideal world, and next year you have $98. But if you're holding hundreds of millions of dollars, that 2% is a giant gaping hole. And then you're forced to, right? I'm not even talking about people that have hundreds of millions of dollars. Let's say the dentist or the plumber that makes a good amount of money every year, right? He is forced to either become a part-time investor, outsource that responsibility to wealth management, you know, Goldman being one of them, but there's Wells Fargo, right? There's all of them. And this kind of creates this bloated financial industry. But now the dynamic completely changed, right? Because now all of a sudden the plumber doesn't need to invest just to maintain his wealth. He could just store his wealth in Bitcoin, and in the process, right, you have these giant, you know, wealth management banks, whatever, they shrink. A lot of their business dries up, it goes away. And I remember when it was Dr. Jeff Ross that told me for this the first time, and I was fascinated. I was like, this is crazy. So you are a fan of something that can potentially affect one of your businesses. And I thought that was really interesting. And I could make the case goes, obviously not anymore because you're at Swan, right? But you could have made the case that that could potentially affect some of Goldman's business, and that might be the reason as to why they're not incentivized to understand the thing in the first place.
Totally, and you're reminding me of something I've said in the past, which is these companies, you know, of course they prefer the world's capital to be forced into investments. Keyword forced. And their companies just so happen to provide access to those investments and earn pretty juicy fees on, you know, what a coincidence. So I think, you know, you're absolutely right. These companies are incentivized to keep the current system going. And that Parker Lewis article, Bitcoin is the Great Dean, that is one of my top five favorite all-time articles, content pieces about Bitcoin. And I think it hits on what I personally think are the four biggest flaws or misunderstandings of our current system. So I could list those quickly, but I think we need these to be recognized and corrected if we're ever going to have a healthy, stable financial system. And the first one is we fail to see a difference between money and debt. The second one is we fail to see a difference between saving and investing. That's the Parker Lewis thesis of that piece. The third one is this belief that 2% annual CPI is somehow this magical number that's good for economic growth. And the fourth one is that we believe a centralized group of people can control the price and supply of money and credit without causing what the Austrians would say malinvestment, which just means bad business decisions, which actually exacerbates economic booms and busts. So I think those are the four key economic dogma ideas of our time that are just outright flawed, and they're going to need to be recognized and corrected. But the one that I'm probably most passionate about is the one you brought up, which is this idea of saving versus investing. And what the current system forces people to do, as you alluded to, not only does a person have to find themselves in a position where they could accumulate money and then save that money, You know, let's think through, how does a person find themselves in that position? They don't just magically get there. So someone would have to listen to their parents, do a good job in school, take your education seriously, learn a skill, market yourself to a productive company or start your own company. But let's say you're getting a job somewhere. You compete for that job, then you excel at the job, then the company pays you for the work you do. And not only that, but what you get paid, you have to defer some of your consumption in order to find yourself in a position where you're saving money. You can't just consume every dollar that you earned. So I look at all of that and I say, that's an incredible achievement. That's what people should be looking to do. That is enough. If they find themselves in a position where they are saving money after they produce something of real value and were voluntarily paid that money, they've already contributed to society's wealth. They've already produced a surplus and they are saving it in the form of money. What these people who believe in a ever inflating money supply, they believe that person not just has to do that thing, that series of steps that I just listed out, but they say, you know what? You're going to have to do one more. You're going to have to become an amateur investor on the nights and the weekends. Because all that money that you just saved up, you're going to have to figure out where to put it in your Fidelity account, which ETFs to buy, which stocks to buy. Oh, should I allocate to gold? Is energy going to do well? All these, is tech stocks going to do well? All these nonsense questions that the average person working a job in America or any country should not be concerned with. These people are forced to do this. And just to hit on one common claim that I've heard, is some people say, well, no, they don't have to pick the investments themselves. They can just give their money to a professional to invest for them. That is just simply flawed logic. And the reason is because if I could pick the professional investor who is going to outperform the market and generate returns, how would I go about picking that person if I'm a complete amateur? I can't tell the difference between investment professional A and investment professional B. It's just as hard to pick a successful investment manager as it is to pick the investment yourself. And if you have a job as in the service industry, as a truck driver, as an Uber driver, as a cashier, you think any, and you know, across any industry, if you work in, if you're a chemist, you're not going to have the ability to pick a successful investment manager. So this whole idea of people must become investors, I think, is intellectually flawed and it's morally flawed. These people should not be forced to become investors. And the last thing that I'll say on this topic is that there's nothing wrong with investing. It should exist. It should just exist in a voluntary and transparent way. Meaning if someone wants to take their savings and put it towards an investment pool, let's just call it for, you know, generic terminology, they can do that. And that's great. And they might earn a good return by doing that. But they shouldn't be forced to do it. And the reason they're forced to do it is because saving money in our current system comes with a negative return. And that does not need to be the case. So I feel very passionately about this one. And I agree with your point about if Bitcoin succeeds, the financial services industry is really, really bloated. It will exist. There will always be investing, but it will be significantly smaller than it is today. And I think that is a massive net benefit for society as a whole.
So sounds like you're not going back to Goldman then.
You know, I don't know if I've completely burned the bridge just yet, but yeah, I don't think it's happening anytime soon.
So yeah, and then not to mention also the unintended consequences, right? We saw, you know, after 2008, 2009, the rise of, hey, perhaps, you know, I don't want to make any of these quote unquote risky investments. Let me put all my money in an index fund. And then you'd create these giant monstrosity Vanguard BlackRock that basically own the world. And it's not their stuff, but they sure do inherit all that voting power from you know, holding those assets. And then that creates just more misaligned incentives caused by the system. And another thing that you said that I found fascinating, right, is the, in a way, that benefits the, that benefits the average man, that benefits the average, the just the, you know, the average Joe, man. They're just trying to save. They're just trying to, you know, earn a living, put food on the table for their family, like all of us, really. But now we're kind of getting in this, you know, timeline where, you know, where Bitcoiners have been coining this. I feel like they've been dying to say this for a long time. We are definitely entering the then they fight you stage. And what blows my mind, right, you know, the recent attempt by, is bipartisan, by the way, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Senator Marshall, to basically force software developers to register with the government to write code, right? And then, of course, we know that Senator Elizabeth Warren has had her crosshairs on Bitcoin for a long time now. She wrote this strong letter to the CEO of Fidelity. And of course, it's all an attempt to slow down adoption, right? That's really what it is. I don't think she genuinely believes that she can kill this thing. But doesn't that blow your mind? That we live in a world where the government is supposed to be by the people, for the people, but because of the incentives of how the current system works, it's really by the government, for the government, because the politicians aren't really interested in serving the constituents. It, of course, it's not black and white, but they're more interested in how do I get closest to the money spigot, right? Doesn't that, for me, as an immigrant, it is the most disheartening, un-American thing I've ever seen, right? That you have people that are more interested in serving themselves rather than the people that they're supposed to be serving, right? Because at the end of the day, if you look at inflation and you see inflation for what it is, it really does hurt the lower and middle classes the most, much more than the upper classes. And someone like Elizabeth Warren, the way that she campaigns is that she's supposedly for the little guy, right? How do you feel about that? Because I think what happened last week was absolutely historic. Of course, you know, according to some friends of mine at BPI, it has a very low percentage of actually passing, right? It's actually seen as an extremist bill in DC. But what they're really trying to do is move the Overton window, right? Not only that, they are also in the process really showing their cards and letting you know exactly how they feel about this thing.
You remind me of one of the things that came across from reading The Sovereign Individual, and it is this idea that when a system is failing, when a system is being threatened, is often when the leaders, I'll call them leaders, of that system start to act quite irrationally and defensive and start overreaching. So the analogy would be the things that the Catholic Church did to hold on to power in the 1500s, the 1600s. And it is some pretty wild things that most people just kind of looked at and said, you know, that's crazy. That's clearly overreach, but there was nothing that they could really do at the time in that moment. But what obviously ended up happening was the Catholic Church lost their power over society, whether they liked it or not. So on the one hand, I look at these things like the bill that was introduced that you mentioned, and obviously I recoil at it because I completely agree it's anti-American. And that hits on something that I think is super important for Bitcoiners to always remember, is if you propose sound money and then, you know, you say, I'm a fan of sound money, and I think Bitcoin is what is going to get us there. The average person is probably going to think you just said something very, very radical. And I think it's important for Bitcoiners to always remember that we are actually proposing going back to a system that we had for hundreds, if not hundreds of years, let's just say. That is very important. We need to remind people that this system of whether it's commercial banks, the Fed, euro dollar offshore banks, whoever's creating new units of money and credit out of thin air, that is actually an anomaly. That is the more recent change in our system. So if the United States was able to function from its founding in the late 1700s up until, let's just say, 1913, when the Fed was created, we functioned in a world of mostly sound money during that time period. So it's not as if we are proposing some crazy thing, some radical solution. We're actually proposing that we go back to a system that is more consistent with the founding principles of this country, for sure. One of the things that I am a little bit that makes me have a little bit of hope for what's going on in America is, if you look at some of these stats about the top 20, they call it crypto penetration, and we probably should take it with a grain of salt, but it's usually developing markets that have had some sort of totalitarian regime, currency crisis, capital controls, etc. And then the United States is in there. And I take that as a small positive that maybe there are people in the US that have not lost sight of the founding principles of this country, that the government is not supposed to be this thing that just knows and sees everything that happens in your life and you ask it for your freedoms. That is absolutely not how this country was founded. This country was founded in a way that the government has limited and defined rights. And one of those is not to have a form of currency that they have complete control over, whether that be creating it, censoring it, et cetera. So those are generally my thoughts on that. Some of it is more pessimistic, because just the very fact that a bill like that is being proposed is obviously not a good thing. But I think there is reason to be optimistic, because I think this might be a situation like the 1500s, where there has emerged a new technology, a new design, that no matter how much the powers that be want to resist it, it might be the case that eventually they can't resist it. They might be able to slow it, but I think there's a good case to be made that they can't resist it. And I am somewhat optimistic that there are at least a chunk of people in America who recognize the principles that this country was founded on. So hopefully Bitcoin is something that brings that more to light amongst those type of people.
Absolutely. And you said something really interesting, that, you know, being an educator, being a Bitcoin educator for about 6 years now, pitching Bitcoin to someone who grew up in Venezuela, pitching Bitcoin to someone who grew up in Argentina, pitching Bitcoin to someone, you know, grew up in Turkey, non-government money, cap supply, can't be debased, can't be censored. They're like, where do I sign up? It's great. Pitching Bitcoin to someone in a developed country, in the West, they don't have that incentive, because the incentive in the developing world is they're adopting it out of necessity, versus people in you know, Alex Gladstein wrote an amazing book. The reality is, in the developed world, we have financial privilege, right? We have great rails, relatively small inflation, which I love the way that Jeff Booth frames it, right? It's like, it's not big enough for you to realize that you're being stolen from, right? And I completely agree with you. You can't stop an idea whose time has come. And I think that's where we really are with Bitcoin. But I'll tell you this, and I was coming to kind of the same conclusion, because I've been working in media, man. You're a slave to the news cycle. It's war. Like, I'm not exaggerating when I say that. Like, they are releasing articles. It's very tactful. You have hit pieces, New York Times, Reuters, and it's dropping. And you have to debunk them. You have to go methodically. And then it gives you kind of like this very detailed chronological order of how things are developing. And you see the dark clouds on the horizon coming towards you. And I'm like, war is coming. Like, again, like, not kinetic, but like, it's coming. And these people are coming hard. And last week really was, from my perspective, when the hammer really fell. And it really reminds me of the article that, you know, Corey wrote, right? The Race to Avoid the War. And then Michael Saylor had this very powerful speech, which is, I want to be a winner. I don't want to be a martyr. And I think we all kind of feel that way. And John, where do you see yourself as an individual in this war? Corey says to avoid the war. Maybe I see it differently because I'm in media, where we're already in one. where do you see yourself in all this? Where do you see yourself in the cog, right? What good fight are you fighting, and how is it pushing the peaceful Bitcoin revolution?
I think I have a pretty clear role in this war, given my background and my interests. So let me start by saying what part of the war I'm not going to be fighting. And that is the part of doing something very technical and building something on Bitcoin, whether it's a privacy tool or any other tool that allows us to use and interact with the Bitcoin network and the various devices more easily. That's just not my background. I am so thankful that we have so many smart people working on those things, but that is not me. Where I think I can make the biggest impact on spreading Bitcoin and this race to avoid the war is in expressing why sound money is not just morally or ethically defensible, but it's also intellectually defensible. So I think this is absolutely critical, because if you take someone, the average person on the street, and they believe, like you mentioned, your buddy who said that the people need monetary policy, which is hilarious. But if that person believes that, they don't believe that sound money, which I will define as non-state, immutable, fixed supply, digital, censorship resistant, peer-to-peer, et cetera, Bitcoin, that will bring about a better economy and a better society than a system where a select few privileged people and entities can create new money and credit out of thin air. If someone doesn't believe that, if they actually believe that a central bank or commercial banks or offshore euro dollar banks, whatever money creator, pick it yourself, if they believe that money and credit being created out of thin air leads to better economic growth, then they don't care about Bitcoin. You'll never get to even explaining what Bitcoin is. You won't be able to say anything about hashes and miners and mempools and nonces and SHA-256 and private keys, because they won't care. They will just say sound money is actually bad. So I think that's the first thing that we need to get across to people, is why is sound money, and Bitcoin is what gives us sound money, why is that going to bring about a better economy and a society than unsound money? And I think, thankfully, this is not one of those things where...
Hold on. Go ahead. You buried the lead there, and I would love to get your perspective on this. Why is it going to create a better society and a better economy? Why is sound money going to do that?
So that, obviously, yeah, great question. We could focus on that for a while, but...
Elevator pitch.
Yeah. There's a moral angle here, and there's an intellectual angle here. The moral angle is that anytime someone creates new units of money slash credit, I'll say, you always have to kind of say that, because credit gets created in our current system and it circulates as money. So whether you're creating credit, you effectively create money in the current system. So whoever is creating new units of money or credit, you dilute the pre-existing holders of money. That is wealth confiscation. That is just an objective observation. If someone tries, there are plenty of things in this world that are debatable. That is not one of them. That is just an objective observation. So what happens when people have the feeling that their wealth is being confiscated? This basically leads to what Bitcoiners call high time preference. People will have a preference for things happening in the present versus things happening in the future. What happens to a society that is very focused on things happening in the present rather than building for the future? That is not a society that ends up making it for the long term, because they don't have a future outlook. That could be systems of government, that could be systems of science, healthcare, food, education, architecture, etc. When time preference shifts to an outlook towards the future, all of those systems that underpin our society become better and stronger. And the reverse is true. When people start caring about the present the most, all of those systems start to break down. So that is a nutshell of why creating money and credit out of thin air is just flat out immoral, because you're confiscating the wealth of other people who did not have a say in the matter. Most people don't even know that it's happening. And then more intellectually, we actually get better systems that underpin our society. And just economically speaking, last thing I'll say is, when you have money and credit creation out of thin air, the short way to say this is it creates economic distortions and it creates outright economic destruction. Basically, in layman's terms, what that means is creating money and credit out of thin air confuses economic participants. This is what gives us the boom bust business cycle. It gives us recessions. We don't actually experience as much economic growth as we could otherwise. And icing on the cake, you know, in case anyone is not sure, the best way to raise people out of poverty is economic growth. It is producing more goods and services. If you mess with the system that produces goods and services, you reduce economic growth. It actually leads to destruction in the human material world. So thankfully, Bitcoin and sound money is one of these things that it's not just morally defensible, it's also intellectually defensible.
Beautifully said. So we have time for one last question, John, and this is something that I've spoken at length with multiple people, and everyone just gives different answers. Alex, specifically, shout out, bro. Cafe Bitcoin is awesome. What are some of the most difficult obstacles that you have seen educating clients, right? Specifically when it comes to Swan Private, right? What has been one of the most one of the largest obstacles? Because from my perspective, right, being a Bitcoin educator, what I tend to run into specifically with, you know, older, very successful gentlemen is, you know, they are looking at this thing purely from an investment perspective. And one of the questions I always get is, so yeah, Bitcoin is great. The line, I never forget this, John. I never forget this. It's like, looks at me straight in the eye, says, Nico, I get it. But for me, the revolution is cool and all, but from an investment perspective, how do I benefit from this? And that question or that statement led to, look at Ethereum. Ethereum is outperforming Bitcoin. So how do you convince clients, right? How do you convince people that are potentially interested in investing in Bitcoin, even though I hate using that terminology, into choosing Bitcoin, not crypto?
So I would say we have a very wide range of people that come to Swan and Swan Private, and many of them are highly educated on Bitcoin and they've spent a long time and probably a long time on it. And thanks to Corey's, warpath that he's been on this year, I think Swan has just developed a reputation for being very outspokenly Bitcoin only. So there's probably not as many people coming and saying, hey, I'm interested in Ethereum. But with that said, some people, they know Swan is Bitcoin only.
Hold on a second. Yeah. So yes, Swan is hardcore Bitcoin only. Facts, 100%. But a lot of older people, right, might not necessarily be attracted to, or might not even care, to be frank, right? Because the fiat system has treated them extremely well, right? So how do you convert these people? Or are you looking at it from the angle of maybe they just don't need conversion? Like, how do you approach that, John?
So those types of people, I would say, I would ask them, why are you allocating to Bitcoin? Why do you want to hold Bitcoin at all? And then I'd say, why do you want to hold Ethereum at all? And I think the two tokens, if you will, the tokens, networks, they're just so, so different from one another. Bitcoin is a finished product, I would call it, that has a clear intent and thesis on what it is meant to be. I think how many times has Ethereum changed their narrative about what they are exactly? I couldn't even tell you what the latest one is. And it's constantly changing and it still requires lots of development to get where they want it to go. It's not an immutable, scarce, non-state, digital, peer-to-peer, censorship-resistant money. That I know for sure. If someone just says, hey, I'm in this for the monetary gains and mm-hmm. I want to get into crypto for that reason, I would say, you know what? Sure, you can do that. By the way, you can also go to a physical casino and do that. And you can actually have drinks served to you, which, you know, you can't do when you invest in Ethereum. But what I would say to them is if you're going to invest in crypto, any crypto, I would say, what do you think you are going to know that is going to allow you to get out at the right time? And by the way, you need to get out at the right time because Swans, Sam Callahan, shout out to Sam, has done the research on this to show how it's like two or three coins have ever made a second all-time high in Bitcoin terms. And when you go through which ones they are, it's like kind of explainable. I think it's like Dogecoin had a second pump for some reason. Basically, these Elon. Coins have, yeah, it, yeah. These coins have like a day in the sun and usually it just goes back down, doesn't come back up. And that, so basically you need to play this game where it's a fun game while you're on it going up and you need to know exactly when to get off. And if you're the Silicon Valley Solana pump and dump guys who got in at a discount and then they got out right before retail was left holding the bag, yeah, that's great for them. If, and then they brag about it on their podcast, right? But if you are someone who's just Joe on the street and you don't have basically inside information for when everyone's going to simultaneously pump the crypto token that you got in on, you're basically just playing at the roulette table, is 100%. What I would tell those people.
100%. That's exactly right. That's what I've said before. And that argument, right? Because everyone's like, oh, the dollar amount. And then you're always like, it's not about the dollar amount. It's how does it perform against Bitcoin? And Ethereum has still not been able to make the all-time high of 2017. And I think that really is the strongest argument as to why Bitcoin, not crypto, of course, just the decentralization, the immutability, rules without rulers, all the beautiful stuff that we love about Bitcoin. But John, I really enjoyed this rip, man. It was great getting to know you and talking about your experiences. And I'm sure as hell going to send this podcast to my buddy over at Goldman. And let's see if he listens to it.
Thanks, Nico. Great to be here. And we will definitely talk more about this soon. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell everybody where they could find you?
Sure. So on Twitter, it's John at Swan. That's John underscore at underscore Swan. And part of the Swan private team. So that's our high net worth concierge offering at Swan. And so I interact with clients. And I'm also trying to put out some content every now and then. So I have an article called How Legacy Finance Perceives Bitcoin. Nico, you could send that to your buddy who is still at Goldman. And then I'm working on another article called Why Fixed Supply Money Does Not Lead to Economic Catastrophe. So hopefully at some point that'll become public soon, and look forward to sharing that with people.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. John, I'm going to put you backstage for about 10, 15 seconds. There's a slight delay. Wrap it up. Guys, thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Remember, this show is powered by Swan Bitcoin, best place to stack sats. Definitely go check out swanbitcoin.com. We will see you tomorrow at 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Simply Bitcoin Live. Love you all. Catch you guys later.